This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin.
Letters from a Stoic by Seneca. Read by Julian Glover.
If you're coming to this Penguin Classic for the first time, then we'd recommend that you skip the introduction for now and return to it later, as it contains details of the plot. Please skip forward to Chapter 1 now if you'd rather not listen to the introduction yet.
Introduction. Seneca's Life. Lucius Annaeus Seneca was born at Cordoba, then the leading town in Roman Spain, at about the same time as Christ. His father, Marcus Annaeus Seneca, was an imperial procurator, who became an authority on rhetoric, the art of public speaking, and debate. He was the father not only of our Seneca, who speaks of his old-fashioned strictness, but also of Novatus, later known as Gallio, the governor of Achaia, who declined to exercise jurisdiction over St. Paul, and of Mela, less ambitious than his brothers, but an able financier, and father of the brilliant young poet Lucan. Seneca suffered severely from ill health, particularly asthma, throughout his life. He tells us that at one time the only thing which held him back from committing suicide was the thought of his father's inability to bear the loss. He spent a period of his early life in Egypt, where the husband of a devoted aunt named Marcia was the viceroy of the Emperor Tiberius from AD 16 to 31, there acquiring experience in matters of administration and finance. He also studied the geography and ethnology of Egypt and India, and developed a lasting interest in natural science, speculative rather than empirical, although Pliny speaks of him as an authority on geology, marine life, and meteorology, and others have admired his remarks on, for example, evolution or the explanation of rings round the sun. His interest was drawn at an early age to Pythagorean mysticism and various cults of Eastern origin, then gaining adherence in Rome, before his final acceptance, in large part, of the Stoic philosophy. After training for the bar, he took successfully to public life, becoming quaestor, in spite of the handicaps of his health, his foreign background, and comparative lack of family or other connections. When Caligula succeeded Tiberius in AD 37, Seneca had become a leading speaker in the Senate and so aroused the jealousy of the new emperor that, according to Dio Cassius, he ordered his execution, and was only induced to let him off by a woman close to the imperial throne who said that Seneca was suffering from advanced tuberculosis, and it would not be long before he died. This incident apparently resulted in his temporary retirement from political affairs. In AD 41, in the first year of the reign of Caligula's successor, Claudius, Seneca again came under sentence of death, commuted to banishment, for reasons which we do not know. The pretext was adultery with Julia Livilla, the late emperor's sister. The more likely explanation is that the new ruler's consort, the notorious Messalina, considered him dangerous. His exile on the island of Corsica does not seem to have been endured as stoically as it might have been. The encouraging spirit of an essay of consolation sent to his dearly loved mother, Helvia, is entirely absent in another addressed to Polybius, an ex-slave who had become a trusted servant of the emperor, which contains some abject flattery and was probably never meant to be published. He had by now suffered the loss not only of his father, but of a son, and his first wife died while he was away. The only solace for him in these 8 long years of loneliness and near despair was the reception given to the poems, tragedies, and essays to friends, which he continued composing during his banishment. His fortunes turned dramatically in AD 49. Messalina had been executed, and the emperor's new wife, Agrippina, had Seneca recalled to Rome, appointed to the high office of praetor, and made tutor to her 12-year-old son, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, the boy who was shortly to become the emperor, Nero. Agrippina's motives, according to Tacitus, apart from the instruction of her son, were a confidence that because of his literary fame, the move would gain them popularity, and a belief that he would prove a reliable ally and a useful adviser to herself and Nero in their plans for future power. There is no evidence that Seneca was connected with the poisoning of Claudius in AD 54. But he wrote the speeches which the 17-year-old Nero delivered after his accession, and was probably the author of a witty, if to us a little tasteless, attack on the dead ruler's memory. The Apocalypsyntosis, or Pumpkinification, an imaginary tale of the rebuffs received by the recently deceased emperor when he presents himself at the portals of heaven and his application for admission is debated by the gods. Nero did make a formal speech in honour of his predecessor, which was said to display a great deal of polish, and to be a good example of Seneca's attractive style well tuned to the ears of his time. The new regime opened well, and Nero's first 5 years were later spoken of as a period of unequalled good government, the Emperor Trajan even calling them the finest period in the history of Imperial Rome. For this, Rome was indebted to Seneca and an army officer named Burrus. These two, the most influential as well as the most enlightened of the men who surrounded Nero, according to Dio, whose wide experience was common knowledge, Tacitus, prevented the hot-headed young man from carrying out a lot of murders on his accession and aimed at channeling some of his energies into permissible pleasures. Only briefly alarmed by the poisoning of Britannicus, and acting throughout in complete harmony, they succeeded in keeping public business out of Agrippina's hands, and in their own. Tacitus ascribes the secret of the influence of Seneca to his tuition of Nero in public speaking, and his engaging manners and high principles, and that of Burrus to his military responsibilities and austerity of character. The two of them, in Dio's words, took over total power and exercised it to the utmost of their ability, in the best and justest way conceivable, thus each alike arousing all men's approval. While Nero amused himself, they set about the problems of government. We notice, to give instances of their activity, legal and financial reforms, including the reduction of indirect taxation, and steps to prevent speculation and extortion by provincial governors, and the prosecution of a successful war in Armenia to settle the empire's eastern frontier. Seneca's geographical interests appear in the dispatch of an expedition to investigate the source of the Nile. Yet another of his interests was shorthand, the Roman system of which he is said to have completely revised. Neither he nor Burrus appears to have held any standing legal or constitutional office that could be said to give them the authority they wielded during these years. Seneca, the real master of the world, seems simply to have been the moving force behind the throne. It is probably safe to say that Nero, unlike Aristotle's celebrated pupil at a similar age, Alexander the Great, was still under the influence of a teacher of undoubted personal charm, and was quite content to leave to him the direction of affairs in which he had little real interest. Once the young emperor began to listen to other advisers, and increasingly to indulge his more violent and vindictive impulses, this happy situation was doomed. In AD 58, Seneca was being attacked by people like Publius Suilius Rufus. Accusations seem to have ranged in gravity from sleeping with the emperor's mother. Obviously the man had failed to learn his lesson from his thoroughly deserved banishment for seducing imperial princesses, and the introduction of the emperor to pederasty, to the usefulness of his studies and the effectiveness of his oratorical style. But the campaign against him generally centred on the apparent contrast, it has been a stock criticism of Seneca right down the centuries, between his philosophical teachings and his practice. Instances of this hypocrisy, according to Suilius, were the philosopher's denunciations of tyranny, which did not stop him from being tutor to a tyrant, of flattery, ill according with the attitude he had adopted, especially from exile, towards ex-slaves who headed departments in Claudius' administration, of extravagance, in spite of allegedly giving banquets served at 500 identical tables of citrus wood with ivory legs, and above all, of wealth. What kind of wisdom, asked Suilius, what philosophical teachings had led him to acquire 300 million sesterces within the space of 4 years in royal favour? The childless and their legacies had been, if he might so put it, enticed into Seneca's net, while all Italy and the provinces were being sucked dry by his practice of lending money at unlimited rates of interest. Seneca was indeed already celebrated for his riches. Juvenal mentions the great gardens of the immensely wealthy Seneca. Agrippina, says Dio, had acquired for him untold wealth from all sources. The agricultural writer, Columella, mentions the remarkable productivity of his wine-growing estates, the best in Italy, at Mentana. The reply, if any, which Seneca gave to his attacker's criticisms of his wealth, was probably that contained in an essay on the happy life, sent to his brother Gallio. What counts, he says, is one's attitude to wealth, which is the wise man's servant and the fool's master. He, like any good Stoic, could lose all he had at any moment without being a whit less happy. This is the core of a long reply to the charge which he states with complete frankness that philosophers do not practice what they preach. His everyday life did not lend countenance to such attacks. We have at least his own accounts of his plain diet and lifelong teetotalism, his hard bed, cold baths and daily runs. And on this occasion he came to no harm from his enemies. In AD 59 Nero had his mother put to death, the murder being carried out in cold blood after the calamitous failure of an attempt to stage an accident at sea. There is reason to believe that Seneca and Burrus had no knowledge of or part in the planning of this crime, but as the facts became known, did their best to lessen its impact on public opinion. Seneca certainly drafted a letter sent to the Senate explaining how her death was the result of the exposure of a dangerous plot of hers against the emperor's life. Dio would have us believe that Seneca averted a general massacre by saying to Nero, "However many people you slaughter, you cannot kill your successor." Tacitus tells us that the death, probably murder, of Burrus in AD 62 broke Seneca's power. Enemies gained the ear of Nero with tales of Seneca's popularity and growing wealth. The first was represented as being dangerous to the throne, the second as overshadowing the possessions of the emperor himself, whose abilities as an artist and a speaker were also, it was said, being disparaged by his old instructor. Nero, they said, was now grown up. It was time for him to shake off his tutor. Seneca, warned of this by friends, realized his danger, and decided to ask the emperor for permission to retire from public life. The request was granted, and the parting was made amicable. For the last 3 years of his life, Seneca devoted himself to philosophy and writing, including the Epistolae Morales to Lucilius Junior, a native of Pompeii, a hard-working higher civil servant, procurator in Sicily at the time, who appears to have dabbled in literature and philosophy. Spending his time moving around southern Italy with Paulina, his second wife, Seneca now rarely visited Rome, and even, to disarm suspicion or for greater safety, gave, says Dio, his entire fortune to the emperor. Tacitus mentions a story of an attempt on his life by poisoning, averted either because a slave gave the plot away, or because the philosopher was in fear of just such an attack, living on an extremely simple diet of fruits growing wild and running water. Then, in AD 65, came the disastrous conspiracy against the emperor by Piso and others, quite possibly including Seneca. There was a report of a sub-conspiracy to kill Piso as well, and make Seneca emperor, being a man who seemed to be marked out for supreme power by the good qualities for which he was so famous. Many people lost their lives on the discovery of the plot. Seneca, like many others, was asked to commit suicide, the then prevailing method of imperial execution. Tacitus' description of his death is not quickly forgotten. His brothers and Lucan followed him, all by their own hands, in the course of Nero's frenzied purge of enemies real and imagined. According to some, a true Stoic, like Cato under the Republic, would have stayed on in political life to the bitter end, but after the loss of all his influence over Nero, the Spaniard could hardly have hoped to be of useful service any longer to the Roman world, and, in an age in which many lived in recurrent dread of a capricious emperor's message, demanding, obliquely or otherwise, the recipient's suicide, the alternative to his retirement was undoubtedly death. Certain other Stoics indeed stood up to the emperors, and were rewarded for their opposition to misrule with martyrdom. Seneca chose to spend what time was left to him in philosophy, and the listener may be left to decide, in fairness not forgetting his chronic ill health, whether his lack of moral courage outside the study, in this or earlier events, detracts from his achievements. Surprisingly, perhaps, the satirist of the century, Juvenal, does not pick on the difference between this public figure's conduct and his philosophical professions, of which a variety of later writers have made play. "Sir, are you so grossly ignorant of human nature?" asked Dr. Johnson, "as not to know that a man may be very sincere in good principles without having good practice?" Seneca, all the same, may well be history's most notable example of a man who failed to live up to his principles. This does not prevent him from being the outstanding figure of his age. Seneca, in those days unsurpassed both in the field of letters and in power, power which afterwards grew too great and recoiled upon his own head, was the last man to be impressed by things which did not count, said his contemporary Pliny. Money, power, or achievement in public life or letters are, despite the interest of the little we know of his career, not the things with which Seneca would want to be connected by people coming across his name today. That he did not expect to be forgotten, we know. In one letter, he actually promises Lucilius immortality through having corresponded with him. But what he would have liked to be remembered for would have been the value of the ideas which, so he tells Lucilius in his 8th letter, he was committing to writing in the hope that they might be of use to later generations. Seneca and Philosophy. Stoicism, for centuries the most influential philosophy in the Greco-Roman world, had a long history before Seneca. Founded by Zeno, born of Phoenician descent in Cyprus, circa 336-5 BC, who had taught or lectured in a well-known stoa, a colonnade or porch, hence the name, in Athens, it had been developed and modified by a succession of thinkers, whose opinions on various logical, ethical, or cosmological questions showed some fair divergences. As a moral creed, however, it was based throughout on the following framework of belief. The Stoics saw the world as a single great community in which all men are brothers, ruled by a supreme providence which could be spoken of almost according to choice or context under a variety of names or descriptions, including the divine reason, creative reason, nature, the spirit or purpose of the universe, destiny, a personal god, even by way of concession to traditional religion, the gods. It is man's duty to live in conformity with the divine will, and this means, firstly, bringing his life into line with nature's laws, and, secondly, resigning himself completely and uncomplainingly to whatever fate may send him. Only by living thus, and not setting too high a value on things which can at any moment be taken away from him, can he discover that true, unshakable peace and contentment to which ambition, luxury, and above all avarice are among the greatest obstacles. Living in accordance with nature means not only questioning convention and training ourselves to do without all except the necessities, plain food, water, basic clothing and shelter, but developing the inborn gift of reason, which marks us off as different from the animal world. We are meant to set free or perfect this rational element, this particle of the universal reason, the divine spark in our human makeup, so that it may campaign against and conquer pain, grief, superstition, and the fear of death. It will show us that There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Discipline the pleasures and the passions, and generally subordinate the body and emotions to the mind and soul. In this way, we shall arrive at the true end of man, happiness, through having attained the one and only good thing in life, the ideal or goal called arete in Greek, and in Latin virtus, for which the English word virtue is so unsatisfactory a translation. This, the summum bonum, or supreme ideal, is usually summarized in ancient philosophy as a combination of four qualities: wisdom, or moral insight, courage, self-control, and justice, or upright dealing. It enables a man to be self-sufficient, immune to suffering, superior to the wounds and upsets of life, often personalized as Fortuna, the goddess of fortune. Even a slave thus armed can be called free, or indeed titled a king, since even a king cannot touch him. Another example of these paradoxes for which the Stoics were celebrated is one directed at the vanity of worldly possessions. The shortest route to wealth is the contempt of wealth. This ethic, together with its backing in a system of physics and logic, had first been given shape in the minds of thinkers who, although Greek-speaking, were for the most part not of European descent, coming from places in Asia Minor or the Levant, like Tarsus, Cyprus, and Babylon. This does not seem to have reduced the appeal it made to educated Romans when, around the middle of the 2nd century BC, it first came to their notice. The duties it inculcated, courage and endurance, self-control and self-reliance, upright conduct and just dealing, simple and unluxurious habits, rationality, obedience to the state, were self-evident to many Romans, corresponding quite closely to the traditional idea of virtus. The development of the jus naturae by the Roman jurists and Posidonius' identification of the Stoic world community, or cosmopolis, with the Roman Empire made its acceptance even easier. At a later date, the Stoic view of the ruler, this term including governors, magistrates, and administrative officials, as a man whose actions could be criticized, and even as a minister or servant, was to be disliked by emperors, some of whom replied by expelling the philosophers. But Stoics were usually far from hostile to monarchy as such, however openly they declared that rank counted for nothing against the duty of all men, whatever their station, to play their part in life well. Despite its wide acceptance in educated circles, early Stoicism had a forbidding aspect, which went far to explain its failure to influence the masses. There was something unreal or fictional about the sapiens, the wise man or philosopher. This ideal figure seemed, from the way the Stoic lecturers talked, to have somehow become perfect in some sudden transformation long ago. Gradual self-improvement was hardly discussed. The target it set seemed too high for ordinary men. It stifled and repressed ordinary human emotions, in striving after apatheia, immunity to feeling. Cato, the great Stoic saint, is reported to have expressed regret at having kissed his wife in a moment of danger. It held that, in certain circumstances, a man's self-respect might invite, as an act of supreme nobility, his suicide. In pursuing the ideal of autarkia, self-sufficiency, it seemed to make the perfect man a person detached and aloof from his fellows, superior to the world he lived in. Altogether, the impression it conveyed, for all its idealism and sincerity, could be cold, dogmatic, and unrealistic. Seneca's contribution to ancient philosophy lay in the humanization of this creed, continuing a process begun long before, in Rhodes and Rome, by Panaetius and Posidonius. Although Seneca wrote for a relatively narrow circle of educated persons, usually addressing his compositions to a particular friend or relative, as if he were that person's special spiritual adviser, his letters and essays show a Stoicism more closely reconciled with the facts and frailty of human nature. The ideal of apatheia is much modified. Self-sufficient though he is, the sapiens can now have friends and can grieve, within limits, at the loss of one. It has become his duty to be kind and forgiving towards others, indeed to live for the other person. In his way of living, he should avoid being ostentatiously different from those he tries to win from moral ignorance. He has to battle, like the rest, against his failings, in a long and painful progress towards perfection, in which all can do, with help from above or the inspiration of others' example. Seneca himself, we observe, occasionally makes immodest statements concerning his own progress, but is capable of humility, as in one description of himself, as a long way from being a tolerable, let alone a perfect human being. In statements of man's kinship with a beneficent, even loving God, and of a belief in conscience as the divinely inspired inner light of the spirit, his attitudes are religious beyond anything in Roman state religion. In his day, little more than a withered survival of formal worship paid to a host of ancient gods and goddesses. Christian writers have not been slow to recognize the remarkably close parallels between isolated sentences in Seneca's writings and verses of the Bible. On the other hand, the word God, or the gods, was used by the philosophers more as a time-honored and convenient expression than as standing for any indispensable or even surely identifiable component of the Stoic system. And the tendency of Stoicism was always to exalt man's importance in the universe, rather than to abase him before a higher authority. The hope of immortality was occasionally held out, but Seneca does not play on it. To him, as to most Stoics, virtue was to be looked on as its own reward and vice as its own punishment. The religious hunger of the masses of his day was to be met not by philosophy, but by the cults of Isis and Mithras and Christianity. For the ancient world, then, apart from reviving philosophy in Latin literature, he spiritualized and humanized Stoicism. What of Seneca and modern philosophy? The latter, at least in the universities of the English-speaking world, has for some time been set on a course which he would certainly have condemned. He would not have understood the attention it pays to ordinary language. And some of his letters, for example Letter 48, make it clear that it would have come in for a share of his impatience with philosophers, not excluding Stoics, who in his eyes degraded philosophy by wasting their time on verbal puzzles or logical hair-splitting. But more than this, he would have denounced the opinion to which most philosophers, tacitly or otherwise, have come round in the last half-century, that it is no part of the business of philosophy to turn people into better persons, as tantamount to desertion or lèse majesté. His tremendous faith in philosophy as a mistress was grounded on a belief that her end was the practical one of curing souls, of bringing peace and order to the feverish minds of men pursuing the wrong aims in life. What we say should be of use, not just entertaining. Even speculation on the nature or meaning of the universe was of secondary importance, something which the philosopher might or might not, as he chose, take up in leisure moments. A philosopher's word should, as a Quaker might put it, speak to our condition. Fielding's observation that few people in the position of being overloaded with prosperity or adversity could be too wise or too foolish not to gain from reading Seneca might have gratified him not merely as an indication that his writings were proving of use to later generations, but also as showing that a philosopher could still be regarded as someone to be turned to for advice or consolation. To Seneca, as Letter 90 and other letters plainly show, the philosopher and the wise man were the same person. Whether or not his letters may still be turned to for their pointers to the contented life, they cannot be read without noticing how far in advance of their time are many of his ideas. On the shows in the arena, for example, or the treatment of slaves. His implicit belief in the equality and brotherhood of man, despite all barriers of race or class or rank, was one resurrected from the days of the early Stoics, which led directly to great improvements in the legal position of slaves, besides explaining the then remarkable attitude towards slaves expressed in Letter 47, the belief was also the germ of the notion of natural law, the law which was thought to transcend national boundaries and form a basis for the validity of international law. These elements of Stoicism made their not-so-small or indirect contribution to the French and American revolutions. Seneca and Literature, His Letters and Other Writings. Seneca, Quintilian tells us, turned his hand to practically everything which can be made the subject of study, speeches, poems, letters, dialogues, all surviving. Much of this is lost, including all his speeches, political and forensic, a biography of his father, and essays or treatises on marriage, superstition, and a variety of other subjects, mainly scientific. The works remaining to us, apart from brief poems or epigrams whose attribution to Seneca is sometimes doubtful, are of two main kinds. There are first the philosophical letters and essays, including treatises with such titles as The Happy Life, The Shortness of Life, Providence, Anger, Clemency, Problems in Natural Science, and literary consolationes to persons in bereavement. And secondly, there are the tragedies, probably never staged, and intended only for reading or recitation among a relatively small circle. The 124 letters to Lucilius comprise something entirely new in literature. For in these, which were his most conspicuous and immediate literary success, Seneca, if anyone, is the founder of the essay. As Francis Bacon put it to Prince Henry in the dedication of his own essays, the word is late, but the thing is ancient, for Seneca's epistles to Lucilius, if one marked them well, are but essays, that is, dispersed meditations, though conveyed in the form of epistles. The Epistulae Morales are essays in disguise. It has been said that they were real letters edited for publication. It seems most likely that they were intended from the first for publication, possibly preceded by an interval of private circulation. No replies have come down to us. The atmosphere varies from that of lively, not to say colloquial, conversation to that of the serious treatises. It is occasionally raised to higher levels, but generally remains informal. The teaching is generously eclectic. The first 30 letters each contain some quotation from, or reference to, writings of the main rival philosophical school, the Epicureans. The introduction of imaginary queries or objections, often scathing in tone, from the correspondent or another interjector, and the frequent and urgent exhortation of the listener to self-improvement, suggest the atmosphere of the diatribe, while confidences about the writer's own character and the not uncommon choice of consolation or friendship as a theme serve to keep up the air of the letter. Personal happenings or surroundings are regularly made the occasion of, or the preliminary to, serious reflections in the abstract. There are also biting condemnations of ways of life around the writer, particularly among the bored and pleasure-seeking Roman aristocracy. Room is found, too, for culture, in an assimilable form, in balanced discussions of time-honoured philosophical or ethical problems, or in the development of thoughts on, for example, poetry or physical phenomena or style. His style. Style, with Seneca, is of considerable importance. Notwithstanding his own condemnation of people who give less attention to what they have to say than how they will say it, he is a signal example of a writer to whom form mattered as much as content. In writers like him, in what has commonly been called the Silver Age of Latin literature, constant striving after terseness and originality of expression gave rise to an arresting and not easily digested style. There were reasons for the development of this pointed style. With the passing of the Republic and succession of a series of suspicious emperors, there had been a diminution both in the range of subject matter, which was safe, and in the practical value of a training in rhetoric for a career in public life. The leisured Roman, now increasingly over-leisured, turned his training to literary rather than political ends, and the means to the prime new end of stylistic brilliance were those of rhetoric. All this was encouraged by the fashion of giving public readings of one's work, in which success almost came to be measured by the ability of each and every sentence to win applause. Carried over, too, from the schools of rhetoric was a liking for sometimes daringly poetic words, especially from Virgil, and artificial forms of expression more typical of verse than prose. Going with the overriding aim of pithiness or epigrammatic brevity, contrasting so greatly with the style of Cicero a century before, was an indulgence in colloquialisms. Seneca's use of popular turns of phrase and everyday expressions, a practice rare in Roman authors not writing for the comic stage or on technical subjects, and deliberate cultivation of the easy conversational manner, are somehow reconciled with elements of style even in the letters, which to us seem highly wrought and polished. The exploitation of such figures as antithesis, alliteration, homoeoteleuta, and all manner of other plays upon words, paradox and oxymoron, apposition and asyndeton, the use of cases and prepositions in uncommon connotations, all contribute to the twin aims of brevity and sparkle. The result may read more naturally in Latin than it ever could in English, but is nonetheless apt to leave the reader dazzled and fatigued. All the wealth and ingenuity of epigram and illustration does not prevent us from feeling that the sentences often simply repeat the same thought, clothed in constantly different guises over and over again, as Fronto complained in the century following. And this reluctance, as it appears, to say what one has to say and then have done with it, instead of continuing the restless manufacture of yet bolder, more hard-hitting or more finished sentences or proverbs, sometimes arouses the impatience of more modern readers. There is Macaulay's celebrated statement in a letter to a friend. "I cannot bear Seneca. His works are made up of mottoes. There is hardly a sentence which might not be quoted. But to read him straightforward is like dining on nothing but anchovy sauce." Quintilian considered that Seneca, whom by and large he respected and admired, weakened the force of his teaching by his manner of writing, and others have wondered whether his style is not unworthy of his subject. It is interesting to hear Quintilian speaking of his struggle to win his students away from such models as Seneca, who, he said, practically alone among authors, was to be found on the shelves of every young man at that time. As an academician, who stood for orthodoxy and a return to the older or Ciceronian manner, he could not bring himself to give the seal of his approval to an author whose writing showed, in his opinion, a degree of corruption all the more dangerous through the very attractiveness of the faults in which it abounds, and who had actually voiced the heresy, "There are no fixed rules of style." His influence and appeal. While scholars and schoolmasters in the century following continued to condemn Seneca, early Christians were taking to this kindred spirit among pagan writers, so many of whose ideas and attitudes they felt able to adopt or share. Anthologies were made of him, and he was frequently quoted by such writers as Jerome, Lactantius, and Augustine. Tertullian called him Sepe Noster, often one of us. The extant set of letters purporting to be correspondence between Seneca and St. Paul, probably composed by a Christian, but apparently believed genuine until quite modern times, led Jerome to include him in his so-called Catalogue of Saints, and no doubt helped to explain his reputation in the Middle Ages, much as the supposed prophecy of the birth of the Messiah in Virgil's fourth eclogue helped to make the latter's name in Christendom. Only Cicero, perhaps, among classical authors, was better known in medieval times, and until Aristotle was rediscovered by Western Europe, Seneca's main scientific work, the Naturalis Quaestionis, was the undisputed authority on the subject with which it dealt. Dante, Chaucer, and Petrarch were great admirers and quoters of his writings. Printing spread his influence, the first printed version of the Epistulae being published in or about 1475 at Rome, Paris, and Strasbourg. Erasmus was the first person to produce a critical edition in 1515, and Calvin's first work was an edition in 1532 of the De Clementia, an essay originally written to encourage clemency in Nero, and incidentally inspiring much of the quality of mercy speech in The Merchant of Venice. Montaigne was the first and the most conspicuously indebted borrower from Seneca among the great modern literary figures. Pasquier's admiration for Montaigne prompted him to say, As for his essays, which I call masterpieces, there is no book in my possession which I have so greatly cherished. I always find something in it to please me. It is a French Seneca. Appreciations of Seneca as a moralist may be quoted from many sources. John of Salisbury is supposed to have said, "If Quintilian will excuse my saying so, there are very few, if any, writers on conduct among non-Christians whose words and ideas can be more readily applied to all kinds of practical things." Emerson urged, "Make your own Bible. Select and collect all the words and sentences that in all your reading have been to you like the blast of triumph out of Shakespeare, Seneca, Moses, John, and Paul." He is placed in even more exalted company by Baudelaire in his essay De l'essence du rire, in which he seems at one point to be ascribing modern civilized manners to La Venue de Jésus, Platon and Sénèque aidant. In Letters to Peter Giles, we find Erasmus writing in the words of Froude, in fraternal good humour, advising him to be regular at his work, to keep a journal, to remember that life was short, to study Plato and Seneca, love his wife, and disregard the world's opinion. Queen Elizabeth I did much admire Seneca's wholesome advisings, says her godson, Sir John Harrington, who saw much of her translating thereof. Although great literary figures have usually been fondest of the letters, it was his plays which, with all their faults, had the greatest effect on European literature. If you seek Seneca's memorial, look round on the tragic stage of England, France, and Italy. The late Elizabethan age and early 17th century were the high watermark of Seneca's influence as a writer well known and imitated among lyric poets and essayists, as well as dramatists. His popularity lasted for some time in France, where his admirers included Descartes, Corneille, La Fontaine, Poussin, Rousseau, Diderot, Balzac, and Sainte-Beuve, but disappeared almost altogether in England. The enthusiasm of, for example, De Quincey, "A nobler master of thinking paganism has not to show, nor when the cant of criticism has done its worst, a more brilliant master of composition," is exceptional, and Seneca, at the present time, may be called a forgotten author. Letter number 2. Judging from what you tell me and from what I hear, I feel that you show great promise. You do not tear from place to place and unsettle yourself with one move after another. Restlessness of that sort is symptomatic of a sick mind. Nothing, to my way of thinking, is a better proof of a well-ordered mind than a man's ability to stop just where he is and pass some time in his own company. Be careful, however, that there is no element of discursiveness and desultoriness about this reading you refer to, this reading of many different authors and books of every description. You should be extending your stay among writers whose genius is unquestionable, deriving constant nourishment from them, if you wish to gain anything from your reading that will find a lasting place in your mind. To be everywhere is to be nowhere. People who spend their whole life travelling abroad end up having plenty of places where they can find hospitality, but no real friendships. The same must needs be the case with people who never set about acquiring an intimate acquaintanceship with any one great writer, but skip from one to another, paying flying visits to them all. Food that is vomited up as soon as it is eaten is not assimilated into the body, and does not do one any good. Nothing hinders a cure so much as frequent changes of treatment. A wound will not heal over if it is being made the subject of experiments with different ointments. A plant, which is frequently moved, never grows strong. Nothing is so useful that it can be of any service in the mere passing. A multitude of books only gets in one's way. So, if you are unable to read all the books in your possession, you have enough when you have all the books you are able to read. And if you say, "But I feel like opening different books at different times," my answer will be this. Tasting one dish after another is the sign of a fussy stomach, and where the foods are dissimilar and diverse in range, they lead to contamination of the system, not nutrition. So always read well-tried authors, and if at any moment you find yourself wanting a change from a particular author, go back to ones you have read before. Each day, too, acquire something which will help you to face poverty or death, and other ills as well. After running over a lot of different thoughts, pick out one to be digested thoroughly that day. This is what I do myself. Out of the many bits I have been reading, I lay hold of one. My thought for today is something which I found in Epicurus. Yes, I actually make a practice of going over to the enemy's camp by way of reconnaissance, not as a deserter. A cheerful poverty, he says, is an honourable state. But if it is cheerful, it is not poverty at all. It is not the man who has too little who is poor, but the one who hankers after more. What difference does it make how much there is laid away in a man's safe or in his barns, how many head of stock he grazes, or how much capital he puts out at interest, if he is always after what is another's, and only counts what he has yet to get, never what he has already? You ask what is the proper limit to a person's wealth? First, having what is essential, and second, having what is enough. Letter number 3. You have sent me a letter by the hand of a friend of yours, as you call him. And in the next sentence, you warn me to avoid discussing your affairs freely with him, since you are not even in the habit of doing so yourself. In other words, you have described him as being a friend and then denied this in one and the same letter. Now, if you are using that word in a kind of popular sense and not according to its strict meaning, and calling him a friend in much the same way as we refer to candidates as gentlemen, or hail someone with the greeting, my dear fellow, if when we meet him his name slips our memory, we can let this pass. But if you are looking on anyone as a friend when you do not trust him as you trust yourself, you are making a grave mistake, and have failed to grasp sufficiently the full force of true friendship. Certainly, you should discuss everything with a friend. But before you do so, discuss in your mind the man himself. After friendship is formed, you must trust, but before that, you must judge. Those people who, contrary to Theophrastus' advice, judge a man after they have made him their friend, instead of the other way round, certainly put the cart before the horse. Think for a long time whether or not you should admit a given person to your friendship. But when you have decided to do so, welcome him heart and soul, and speak as unreservedly with him as you would with yourself. You should, I need hardly say, live in such a way that there is nothing which you could not as easily tell your enemy as keep to yourself. But seeing that certain matters do arise on which convention decrees silence, the things you should share with your friend are all your worries and deliberations. Regard him as loyal, and you will make him loyal. Some men's fear of being deceived has taught people to deceive them. By their suspiciousness, they give them the right to do the wrong thing by them. Why should I keep back anything when I'm with a friend? Why shouldn't I imagine I'm alone when I'm in his company? There are certain people who tell any person they meet things that should only be confided to friends, unburdening themselves of whatever is on their minds into any ear they please. Others, again, are shy of confiding in their closest friends, and would not even let themselves, if they could help it, into the secrets they keep hidden deep down inside themselves. We should do neither. Trusting everyone is as much a fault as trusting no one, though I should call the first the worthier and the second the safer behaviour. Similarly, people who never relax and people who are invariably in a relaxed state merit your disapproval, the former as much as the latter. For a delight in bustling about is not industry, it is only the restless energy of a hunted mind. And the state of mind that looks on all activity as tiresome is not true repose, but a spineless inertia. This prompts me to memorize something which I came across in Pomponius. Some men have shrunk so far into dark corners that objects in bright daylight seem quite blurred to them. A balanced combination of the two attitudes is what we want. The active man should be able to take things easily, while the man who is inclined towards repose should be capable of action. Ask nature. She will tell you that she made both day and night. Letter number 5. I view with pleasure and approval the way you keep on at your studies and sacrifice everything to your single-minded efforts to make yourself every day a better man. I do not merely urge you to persevere in this, I actually implore you to. Let me give you, though, this one piece of advice. Refrain from following the example of those whose craving is for attention, not their own improvement, by doing certain things which are calculated to give rise to comment on your appearance or way of living generally. Avoid shabby attire, long hair, an unkempt beard, an unspoken dislike of silverware, sleeping on the ground, and all other misguided means of self-advertisement. The very name of philosophy, however modest the manner in which it is pursued, is unpopular enough as it is. Imagine what the reaction would be if we started dissociating ourselves from the conventions of society. Inwardly, everything should be different, but our outward face should conform with the crowd. Our clothes should not be gaudy, yet they should not be dowdy either. We should not keep silver plate with inlays of solid gold, but at the same time, we should not imagine that doing without gold and silver is proof that we are leading the simple life. Let our aim be a way of life not diametrically opposed to, but better than that of the mob. Otherwise, we shall repel and alienate the very people whose reform we desire. We shall make them, moreover, reluctant to imitate us in anything, for fear that they may have to imitate us in everything. The first thing philosophy promises us is the feeling of fellowship, of belonging to mankind and being members of a community. Being different will mean the abandoning of that manifesto. We must watch that the means by which we hope to gain admiration do not earn ridicule and hostility. Our motto, as everyone knows, is to live in conformity with nature. It is quite contrary to nature to torture one's body, to reject simple standards of cleanliness and make a point of being dirty, to adopt a diet that is not just plain but hideous and revolting. In the same way as craving for dainties is a token of extravagant living, avoidance of familiar and inexpensive dishes betokens insanity. Philosophy calls for simple living, not for doing penance, and the simple way of life need not be a crude one. The standard which I accept is this. One's life should be a compromise between the ideal and the popular morality. People should admire our way of life, but they should at the same time find it understandable. Does that mean we are to act just like other people? Is there to be no distinction between us and them? Well, most certainly there is. Any close observer should be aware that we are different from the mob. Anyone entering our home should admire us rather than our furnishings. It is a great man that can treat his earthenware as if it was silver, and a man who treats his silver as if it were earthenware is no less great. Finding wealth an intolerable burden is the mark of an unstable mind. But let me share with you, as usual, the day's small find, which today is something that I noticed in the Stoic writer Hecato. Limiting one's desires actually helps to cure one of fear. Cease to hope, he says, and you will cease to fear. But how, you will ask, can things as diverse as these be linked? Well, the fact is, Lucilius, that they are bound up with one another, unconnected as they may seem. Widely different though they are, the two of them march in unison like a prisoner and the escort he is handcuffed to. Fear keeps pace with hope. Nor does their so moving together surprise me. Both belong to a mind in suspense, to a mind in a state of anxiety, through looking into the future. Both are mainly due to projecting our thoughts far ahead of us, instead of adapting ourselves to the present. Thus it is that foresight, the greatest blessing humanity has been given, is transformed into a curse. Wild animals run from the dangers they actually see, and once they have escaped them, worry no more. We, however, are tormented alike by what is past and what is to come. A number of our blessings do us harm, for memory brings back the agony of fear, while foresight brings it on prematurely. No one confines his unhappiness to the present. Letter number 6. I see in myself, Lucilius, not just an improvement, but a transformation. Although I would not venture as yet to assure you, or even to hope, that there is nothing left in me needing to be changed. Naturally, there are a lot of things about me requiring to be built up, or fined down, or eliminated. Even this, the fact that it perceives the failings it was unaware of in itself before, is evidence of a change for the better in one's character. In the case of some sick people, it is a matter of congratulation when they come to realize for themselves that they are sick. I should very much like, then, to share this all-so-sudden metamorphosis of mine with you. Doing so would make me start to feel a surer faith in the friendship that exists between us, that true friendship, which not hope nor fear nor concern for personal advantage ever sunders, that friendship in which and for which people are ready to die. I can give you plenty of examples of people who have not been lacking a friend but friendship, something that can never happen when mutual inclination draws two personalities together in a fellowship of desire for all that is honourable. Why cannot it happen? Because they know that everything, and especially their setbacks, is shared between them. You can't imagine how much of an alteration I see each day bringing about in me. Send me too, you will be saying, the things you found so effectual. Indeed, I desire to transfer every one of them to you. Part of my joy in learning is that it puts me in a position to teach. Nothing, however outstanding and however hopeful, will ever give me any pleasure if the knowledge is to be for my benefit alone. If wisdom were offered me on the one condition that I should keep it shut away and not divulge it to anyone, I should reject it. There's no enjoying the possession of anything valuable unless one has someone to share it with. I shall send you, accordingly, the actual books themselves, and to save you a lot of trouble hunting all over the place for passages likely to be of use to you, I shall mark the passages, so that you can turn straight away to the words I approve and admire. Personal converse, though, and daily intimacy with someone, will be of more benefit to you than any discourse. You should really be here and on the spot. Firstly, because people believe their eyes, rather more than their ears, and secondly, because the road is a long one, if one proceeds by way of precepts but short and effectual, if by way of personal example. Cleanthes would never have been the image of Zeno if he had merely heard him lecture. He lived with him, studied his private life, watched him to see if he lived in accordance with his own principle. Plato, Aristotle,